dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who brings prodigious intelligence to bear on several dimensions of this war for the free world, partly based on his successful experience in the business and finance sector of the United States economy, partly as a result of his present function, which is as a television podcaster par excellence with the Bill Walton Show, partly because of his leadership of an important conservative movement organization, the Council for National Policy, of which I'm privileged to be a member. Bill Walton is a go-to guy for a topic that I think has to be top of mind for all of us, namely, what is happening to fundamentally transform our country through a kind of pincer movement, if you will, that really is kind of fascistic in character, born of a radical leftist Biden-Harris administration on the one hand and so-called woke capitalists on the other. Bill Walton, it's good to have you with us as always. Thank you for joining us as you do each week. And tell us what we should make of what does seem to be this increasingly formidable effort being made by both the government and its friends in the business sector to fundamentally transform the United States of America.
Well, Frank, great to be with you. Frank, we've talked about this a bit before. The old notion that big business was on the side of the conservatives and that was something to be fought if you were a progressive liberal, it's been utterly changed. What's happened is most of the major corporations, not all, but most, have been captured by the woke progressives. And, you know, the process has been getting control of the corporate affairs, diversity groups, human resources, the foundation, government affairs, PACs. You know, PACs recently for a lot of the major corporations are no longer going to give money to Republicans. And of course, there's always the marketing departments. And now we've got a looming issue, which is Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, who is among the most woke CEOs that I know, has a corporate social government environment, a government environmental agenda. And he's now using the $9 trillion that BlackRock oversees to weigh in on proxies. You know, corporations every year put out proxies and shareholders get to put items on it. Well, that whole process is dominated by the left, and they're putting environmental items on it. And the thing to keep in mind with Larry is that his company, BlackRock, not only the $9 trillion, they're in the top three shareholders of more than 80% of the companies in the S&P. So it's not just a few big companies, but it's all the companies in the S&P that Larry has influence over. And of course, if you're CEO and you've got BlackRock, which can move a lot of money around, telling you this or that, you tend to do it.
Yep. And he has made it very clear that they will do it, or he will change their board of directors and their, you know, corporate structure, if need be, using the kind of power that you've talked about. I must say, Bill, I'm stunned by this latest information. I had thought he only had $7 trillion to do this with, but now it's up to nine.
Well, who's counting?
Yeah, well, I am, for goodness sake. We all better. So your point, Bill, is, though, that we're seeing this convergence between people who now want this so-called ESG agenda, environment, social justice, governance, and a government that is trying to mutate, for example, not exclusively, but prominently, our energy sector beyond recognition. And the combined effects of these can be irresistible, I assume, and therefore very dangerous for America as we've known it in terms of free market capitalism on the one hand, but also energy security and more generally our national security, no?
Well, it's true, but there's a there's an ironic sliver of hope here, you know, because of BlackRock's view about energy companies. They own the lowest percentage of energy companies of any major industry. I think it's about 50%. So 50% of the energy companies don't have BlackRock as an investor. Now, that's just a slender point in the face of what is a much, much bigger problem. And it's not just the energy companies that are being influenced. You know, every company is now being asked to say what its environmental policies are, and you know what they're doing to save the climate, prevent global warming, et cetera. And if you get a proxy item on that, and you got Larry Fink saying you got to vote, you know, shareholders should vote for it. That's a threat.
Yeah, and there are also these organizations that sort of manage these proxy exercises, and they are very squarely in the hands of the left. So it's even more of a rigged game, isn't it? The main point, Bill, this as you look at this as a, you know, former senior figure in the international and certainly domestic business sector, is there any hope that we will see it, you know, righting the ship in due course? Because fundamentally, it does seem as though it will impair, you know, profitability. It will undermine shareholder value. It will be really a burden on the economy of the United States, will it not, this agenda?
Well, I think there is hope if we take a line of action by remembering that these corporations are not impersonal things. They're run by people, and those people can be influenced. And there's an example of what happened with Major League Baseball pulling an All-Star game out. And they now are feeling fairly contrite because a lot of us went after the CEO of Major League Baseball, and they've lost a lot of the fans because of that. And the other story is that Ed Bastian, who's quite a progressive leader of Delta Airlines, we're now targeting him because you know half the people that fly Delta don't agree with Ed. And you know they were also Delta was also the one calling out the Georgia legislature for a very, very reasonable voting law, which they said was discriminatory. So my view about how to get at this is that, you know, and Larry Fink's a good example. It's not BlackRock, it's Larry Fink. And so I think to the extent we make this his cause, and I think we've got it's sort of like with the social media companies. I don't think Jack Dorsey is a particularly attractive face of people who should be censoring us. And so there's an opportunity of pressure on these people as individuals.
Yeah. It's absolutely necessary to hold these folks accountable. And I think you're right. You're taking a page out of Fultzola Linsky's book, Personalize It. You know, freeze it, fix it, as they say. These are the sorts of things that do work indeed, and they need to be brought to bear for the right, not just for the radical left. Bill Walton, thank you very much for your time today and for your leadership of our movement and for your joining us to talk a bit about it each week. We're deeply appreciative and look forward to doing so next week. Stay well, my friend. Jeff Nyquist is up next. We'll talk with him about the context in which a lot of this is happening, the socialist Marxist agenda. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Jeff Nyquist. He goes by J.R. Nyquist. You can find his extraordinarily impressive essays at jrnyquist.blog. He is the author of a number of really important books, including The Origins of the Fourth World War, and most recently, The Fool and His Enemy. And I'm always, I think, really privileged to be able to present to you his insights into some of the most important issues of our time, including an analysis that he has done of what he calls the death knell of the Anglo-Saxons at his blog. Jeff, it's good to have you with us, and I want to drill down on that topic because it's I think both enormously insightful and chilling in its implications. Talk to us about it if you would.
It is chilling. The problem that we have, and that we're seeing it throughout the Western world, is that you have governments that are against their own people. The U.S. government could be said in some respects to be anti-American. And you could say, like what's happening in France, the French government, as this letter of French generals has said, is anti-French. And so we are afraid, if we're for ourselves, we're racist, we're Islamophobic, and we're phobic of everything. And to be for yourself is somehow to be against everybody else. So we're not allowed to be for ourselves. And this includes in immigration policy and of course, domestic social policy and foreign policy with regards to China. Because if you're somehow for, having fair trade and you're against China's trade practices, you're racist. So, which is what, this dispute between Australia and China, which is getting worse, and China is punishing Australia with trade. The latest slap up has been that, hey, China's a threat. And so the Chinese general, Jin, has said, well, the Australians are just a bunch of, Anglo-Saxon Christian white supremacists.
Which brings us to the point that one of the themes of the Chinese influence operations, we'll be talking more about those momentarily with Sam Faddis, is this notion that racism is endemic or systemic, if you will, in the West, in the United States in particular, Australia as well, I guess. And Jeff, you tie this sort of nostrum and the so-called Great Reset and the Biden phrase build back better rather directly to socialist or Marxist revolutionary, sort of doctrines. Talk to us about that, if you would.
Well, if you go and you read the program of the Communist Party USA, it's rather striking. Now, this program was first written in 2004. And it's been updated a little bit, and they've got a new introduction for the pandemic. But what this program basically says is we're going to take all the racial minorities and the transgenders and the women, the feminists, and we're going to make a supermajority, and we're going to crush the ultra right. And the ultra right is the males and the Christians. And they're the ones that are holding back the system from becoming socialist. So, and the other thing is, they say, look, we need to kind of riot. We need to push it beyond legality because we have to get rid of this constitution because the constitution really prevents socialism and democracy from finally winning because the ultimate form of democracy is economic democracy, which is that, basically you get rid of capitalism. That old thing that we heard about years ago, economic democracy, which is just another word for Marxism. It sounds better. And this is what they're pushing is the Great Reset as well.
Basically, what you're saying is that they are past masters, really, these radical leftist, socialist, Marxist, whatever you want to call them, progressives, at the euphemism, the way of just sort of masking the true intent with words that sound nice, words that, as Frank Luntz famously says, words that work, but that actually are designed to deceive and manipulate and subvert, are they not?
Yeah, and that's what they're doing. I mean, they're using the pandemic. They would have used global warming. They'll use immigration. They'll use any issue to advance socialism. And by stirring up the races against each other, and this is what's occurring in France, it's what's occurring here, stirring up people along racial lines and saying that basically socialism is the only answer. And so you have to get rid of France, you have to get rid of the United States, you have to get rid of Australia. And meanwhile, the Chinese are over there kind of being an echo chamber for this whole thing, which is really interesting because China is a communist country ruled by the communists. So we can see it all kind of comes together here in terms of the domestic socialists, the domestic unrest, and the Chinese military buildup, and of course the Russian military buildup that's united and corresponding with the Chinese buildup. So we have a kind of revolution in the West and a kind of military buildup in the East, and here's the connection.
Let's talk a little bit more about this French situation, Jeff, because the warnings that have been issued by respected, accomplished, decorated military veterans in France have been ramping up. And it sounds very much as though they are warning of an impending, if not actually already ongoing, civil war within France, albeit at the moment not yet, you know, fully kinetic and horrific, but nonetheless in the works. What are your thoughts about how far gone France is and whether this letter might actually represent a turning point that spares that country and perhaps others in the West what certainly the Islamists among them and doubtless the communists and others who are willing to make a red-green axis for the purpose of taking down these Western capitalist democracies have in mind?
Yeah, well, May Day, May 1st, which was just, a few days ago, 4 days ago, was very violent in France. And of course, Antifa, the communist and the communist mob and the Islamist mob have been pulling down statues there. They've been doing what we saw here last summer. And the French generals last month, 20 retired French generals and over 100 high-ranking French officers and 1,000 enlisted, signed on this letter, which was published in a what the French media says is a right-wing magazine. But the letter in brief says the French government is anti-French and it's destroying the country because these mobs are destroying the country and they won't act. And parts of France are now off limits to French because they've been taken over by Islamists. And so the consequence is the French government had better enforce the laws of France and uphold France, or we're going to have a civil war and the military is going to have to intervene. It says something like our active duty comrades will be forced on a perilous mission of restoring the country. This has created a storm of protests from the leftist parties, from the government. The Minister for Armies, Florence Parly, has basically said that it's against the Constitution what the generals wrote, that they have to be disciplined, that any active duty personnel who signed the letter have to be prosecuted. The chief of the French General Staff, François Lecointre, has said similar things. And then this massive, this unbelievable letter from the former head of the Legion, the French Foreign Legion, General Christian Piquebal, has basically gone after the chief of the general staff, saying that he is basically a coward and he is not upholding his comrades in the military and his duty is to the country and he's betraying the country. And the letter ends with profound contempt. And of course, 58% of French are behind the generals.
Let me ask you about one piece of this, which you touched on a moment ago, because I've been hearing rumor of a similar thing here in the United States, but haven't seen much evidence of it to date. You touched on the fact that in this rioting that took place on May Day, most recently, Islamists are playing a prominent role in tearing down statues and so on. Jeff Nyquist, what is your assessment of the Muslim Brotherhood's engagement with the radical left in this country? Are we seeing partnering in the rioting that has taken place to date here in many cities across the country, notably Portland, of course, but Minneapolis and others as well? And do you expect more of that in the future?
Yeah, well, I think in Minneapolis we've seen it. And I think so. You see it in Congress. With certain representatives, but this alliance between the communists and the Muslim Brotherhood goes back to the 1960s. It goes back more than a half a century. There has been a kind of underground alliance between you see it in Jordan, and I forget the exact year in the 1960s, where the Muslim Brotherhood and the communist underground in Jordan started working together.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend, I guess, is the working model. Jeff, this is a topic to which I want to return with you. This is such an important point because the Muslim Brotherhood is a very, I think, pernicious influence inside Muslim communities in this country. And its agenda is clearly, as is that of the left, taking down the United States. In their case, they seek, you know, a Sharia state instead of a communist one, I suppose. But for the moment, they're prepared to make common cause. I think that's clear. And we want to get more insights into that. So we look forward to talking with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you for your efforts to keep us all clued up about challenges we're facing, foreign and domestic, and the work you do at jrnyquist.blog. Keep it up, my friend. Talk to you again next week. Next up, we will speak with Robert Joseph, former Undersecretary of State, about what the Biden administration is doing with and for Iran, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Sam Faddis, a former undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, among many other incarnations he has served in, both in government and in private life, to the great benefit of our country. He is the author of several important books, including one that I think is particularly pertinent to topic A today, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Sam, it's good to have you with us, and I'm anxious to pick your brains about evidence of just how beyond repair the CIA is.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm happy to talk about how beyond repair they are, although it makes me cry a little bit.
I can only imagine. Let me play for our audience just a short piece of remarkable, I guess, appalling promotional video, an advertisement for, I guess, recruitment for the Central Intelligence Agency that has just been released under its Biden administration management. Let's go to the audio tape. 3, 2, 1. So, Sam, what do you make of that as a former career Central Intelligence Agency employee?
Yeah, well, I you know, I watched it and I cried a little bit and I laughed a little bit and then I probably cried some more. I mean, it's sad, right? I have a picture here in my desk in my office where I'm sitting right now of a team of, that I was in charge of in Iraq. One of the few photos I have of a agency team in the field, and you know, there's black guys and white guys and girls and boys and Hispanic folks and Asian folks, and I know all of them, and that's all wonderful, but it's also irrelevant, right? The only thing that matters is that they could do their jobs, that they were effective, that they knew what they were doing, and certainly that's the way they looked at each other and operated in the field. And that commercial for whatever it is for the agency, which is this obsession with all sorts of personal characteristics and this sort of overwhelming narcissism, and that somehow or another all obsession in and of itself achieves something, and that's the goal. And when I watch it, I think it's great that you can change a baby diaper, I think the lady says at one point. And I don't know whether it doesn't tell me anything about whether you can actually collect intelligence in the field and keep from getting caught and keep us safe in our beds at night.
Right. And Sam, again, having spent a lot of time in very dangerous places going up against some of the world's worst regimes, what do you think our adversaries are making of all of this?
Well, they're making of it exactly the same thing they make of the obsession that DOD has right now with the same kind of nonsense. They laugh about it. They disparage it. And rightly so, you know, in the end, CIA officers.
But do you think they're emboldened by it?
Without question. I mean, they think, they look at us and they think this is a joke. And again, rightly so, because it's not, all of this is coming at the cost of a focus, again, on the only thing that matters. Can you, as a CIA officer, go out there in the field, crawl into the belly of the beast, go into those dark, dangerous places in the world and actually recruit sources, keep them alive, and give us the intelligence we need? And unfortunately, I think you see on the front pages every day that the answer to that question increasingly is no, we are not doing that.
And if we are not doing it, and if we are emboldening enemies, including enemies who are doing that sort of thing against us, we are undoubtedly intensifying the peril we face. Which brings me to the next topic, Sam. Among the things that you would have done in your previous life would be trying to subvert enemies of this country by operating in various, presumably mostly shadowy ways inside their own country, influencing people, manipulating, you know, government employees, recruiting spies and the like. I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about what we are increasingly learning about the extent to which the Chinese Communist Party is doing precisely those sorts of things to us in what can only be described as an incredibly comprehensive, multi-prong, thorough, and seemingly very well-resourced influence operational infrastructure and assault. Talk a little bit about what we've learned in just the past few, well, years, I guess now, about what they're up to.
Well, as with all aspects of their operations, they have a gigantic whole of government approach to this issue. It is massive. It is well-resourced. It's been ongoing for decades, and it is incredibly effective. I think most Americans are completely unaware of how effective it is. The example I use talking about this all the time is the Wuhan lab situation in regard to the pandemic. The pandemic appears, the totality of the information that we have available, which I won't try to detail at this point because we don't really have the time, but the totality of the information we know that is in possession of the U.S. government and including people like Dr. Fauci at the time tells us almost certainly theory number one has got to be this virus just came out of the Chinese lab in Wuhan. We can debate whether it was bioengineered and related to biological warfare or they just got sloppy. But the totality of that information made that theory number one and frankly, almost certainly the answer. Instantaneously, the Chinese say.
And by the way, that laboratory was a biological weapons laboratory.
We should not discount the possibility it's related to bioweapons at all, because we know in that lab there's bioweapons research and military personnel. But at a minimum, we have to say theory number one is it came out of that lab. Immediately, the Chinese Communist Party swings into action, trots out a ridiculous story about a seafood market, even though the virus clearly came out of a bat and bats are not even sold in this market and don't even these bats don't even aren't even native to the region where this is. They trot out this ridiculous story within moments. Every mass media, virtually every mass media market in the United States picks up the story and runs with it. And the next thing you know, people are being censored, myself included, on every social media outlet in the United States, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, literally in Chinese communist fashion, shutting down anybody who counters a narrative that began in Beijing as Chinese propaganda. Now, that ought to terrify people because that's the reality of what happened. Chinese Communist Party decreed this story is not allowed to be told. And the next thing you know, Americans are being censored. And to this day, most of them probably still believe that that's true. They don't even understand that they're parroting a Chinese propaganda story.
So, Sam, this is a case in point. But in addition, we've seen them operating on American campuses. We've seen them recruiting under the so-called Thousand Talents Program, professors and researchers and others, officials. We've watched them recruiting people through a voter registration drives across the country, including many aimed at changing red states blue, as they say, and some successfully so. We've even heard a story that's just come out of the National Pulse. A terrific young reporter there, Natalie Winters, yesterday, I think, wrote up something called the Erickson Institute. And what it has been doing, apparently a radical leftist operation to inculcate Chinese communist nursery rhymes, for heaven's sakes, in our, you know, kindergarten kids. What on earth is going on in this sort of leave no stone unturned level of effort?
Yeah, it's another one of those you don't know whether to laugh or cry moments. I mean, the Erickson Institute is actually a very big, very influential institute focused on graduate level education. They're based in Chicago. And they're in formal partnership with an outfit called the China Children's Press and Publication Group, which is an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party focused on indoctrinating young people. It's straight out of the Young Pioneers in the old Soviet Union, or the equivalent in the Third Reich. It's a mold the minds of the youth so they are loyal communist institute. And the Erickson Institute in the United States is in formal partnership with these guys to now produce publications to be disseminated inside the United States. This is, when you hear that out loud, you're like, my God, that can't be true. And yet it is true. Kids in the United States are going to be fed Chinese propaganda, straight up.
We're going to talk more about this Erickson Institute with Trevor Loudon later in the week, because he's done some interesting deep dive research on the leftist character of that operation and some of its prominent associates. We'll titillate you with that in the days to come. But Sam Faddis, I guess where I want to leave this is that we are in mortal risk of having such, again, multifaceted efforts translating into a lack of understanding of the nature of the threat we face, at the minimum, and at worst, actively recruiting and you know, indoctrinating Americans into believing that submission to the Chinese is, you know, the only future for our country. And this comes at a particularly perilous moment because we have a government that seems to be all about that as well. And I just want to say, I'm deeply appreciative of both what you have done to protect our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic, an oath you took, as did I, to do. And it's perhaps your most important work right now, what you're doing at andmagazine.com, Sam, to alert us to these risks. And we appreciate so much your visiting with us each week to talk about them. And we'll look forward to catching up with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you for your collective service, including that you're doing now. To our country. Godspeed. Keep it up. Next up, we'll speak with Ambassador Robert Joseph about the Iran deals that the administration is pursuing and what they might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a longtime colleague, very dear friend, and much admired public servant. His name is Dr. Robert Joseph. He served, among other things, as an ambassador to the Standing Consultative Commission back in the day when there was such a thing and the Soviet Union still strode the globe. He served with great distinction in the Defense Department, in the State Department, and at the National Security Council in a variety of capacities, most recently as the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. He is a, well, duty expert for us on, among other things, nuclear weapons proliferation. He's done a lot over the years to try to curb it, in particular, disarming the Libyan nuclear weapons program, almost single-handedly. And we're delighted always to have a chance to catch up with him, especially in the aftermath of an important piece that he published at National Review last week entitled, "The Biden Administration's Fact-Free Frenzy to restart the Iran nuclear deal. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, thank you. Appreciate the kind words and appreciate the invitation to join you again.
Well, the invitation is a permanent one. You're always welcome. Let me ask you about this fact-free frenzy, which you can't say 10 times fast, but it's apt, it seems. The administration and the personnel populating it are, as we've discussed before, besotted, it seems, with this idea that they will be able to negotiate another deal with the Iranians on preventing them from getting what they clearly aspire to, namely a nuclear weapons capability. Tell us about what seems to be shaping up as a result of this frenzy, Bob, in terms of both the substance and the process.
Well, I think it's beyond a determination to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, to reestablish the U.S. Involvement in the fatally flawed nuclear agreement that was negotiated in the Obama years. It's a fixation. It's an article of faith held by the newly reappointed officials of the Biden administration, who believed in the Obama years that the agreement, the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement with Iran, was the pinnacle of success of the foreign policy, despite its many flaws. And now, despite the fact that Iran has demonstrated that it maintained the capability to break out in terms of moving forward to gain a nuclear weapon at any time of its choosing. And yet, as I said, as an article of faith, the administration moves forward in a way that ignores the facts, changes in the security environment, for example, and in fact distorts the facts, because the maximum pressure campaign of the previous administration, of the Trump administration, was actually working. It was putting a great deal of pressure on the religious dictatorship in Tehran.
In your time in the State Department, Bob, I know you have honed the craft of wordsmithing. So we've had frenzy, we've had fixation. I would offer fetish is another F word that seems to apply here. And the fetish is, as you say, really crazy making insofar as the policy didn't work, was supplanted by a better one, and has now, as a result of this administration coming to office and pursuing this preoccupation of theirs, seemingly reinforced the Iranians' belief that they can have their way with the United States and the rest of the international community. So if you were a bookmaker at this point, Bob, what are the chances that we're going to see an Iranian nuclear weapon? And how soon?
That's a difficult question to answer. But I think with a great deal of certainty that the regime will have the ability to rapidly break out and acquire a nuclear weapon at the time of its choosing. They have demonstrated that they can enrich the uranium. They're now enriching at 60%. The difference between 60% and highly enriched uranium used in a nuclear bomb is very small. They're making uranium metal today, and there's only one purpose for uranium metal, and that is for a nuclear weapon. So they're putting themselves in this position so they can rapidly acquire a nuclear weapon whenever they desire. And the administration is going along with it. I mean, the administration is giving everything to the to the regime that they're asking for. But interestingly enough, the regime is in a position where they're having trouble taking yes for an answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, as is often the case, I guess. Let's just hone down on that point that you just made, Bob, because I think, you know, we hear about these advanced centrifuges that the Iranians have been building. We've heard talk that the Israelis have set them back some time as a result of a explosion, or several even, at Natanz, one of the secret facilities that is associated with this Iranian nuclear weapons program. But we've endlessly been told, well, they're getting close. They're going to have, they're working towards, they will acquire the means by which to have a bomb. At what point does all of this actually translate into breakout? by the Iranians? And what would it look like? Would you expect them to test a nuclear weapon in some fashion? Would you expect them simply to go ahead and use one, perhaps, as they've often signaled is their intent with respect at least to the little Satan, Israel, if not the great one, namely us?
Well, I think these questions are likely being discussed by the regime officials in Tehran. When do we test, or do we test first before we actually deploy a operational nuclear capability? And you're absolutely right. I mean, the supreme leader has made very clear that his number one priority is to wipe Israel off the map. And Israel, you know, is a small country, and it won't take but two or three nuclear detonations. And the Israelis know this, and they're acting in self-defense. But the problem is that the approach that we're taking will strengthen the regime in Iran and undermine the capabilities of our allies to defend against the Iran threat.
Yeah, it, strengthening is one thing. Actually emboldening them to act in this manner is what's particularly concerning. Bob, which brings us lastly to...
If I could just make one more point, what the administration says in response to these criticisms is that, well, this is the first step. We just need to rejoin the JCPOA. Again, paying once again for a bad deal. But we will rejoin the JCPOA, and then we will negotiate an agreement with the Ayatollahs that constrain their capability in terms of missiles, that constrain their aggression in the region, that constrain their support for terrorism. All of this will come next. And that's a fool's game, of course, because those are what we wanted to achieve in the first round. And the Supreme Leader said no. And there's no indication that that will ever change.
Right. And nor should it, given the circumstances. Which brings us lastly, Mr. Secretary, to John Kerry, the sort of czar of global climate change for the Biden administration, who has been instrumental in so many of the problems, notably with this Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. What do you make of the fact that the Iranian foreign minister had called him out, basically, for having provided the Iranians with, it sounds like, sensitive information about 200 Israeli military actions against Iranian forces in Syria?
No, it's really quite incredible. And there is so much in that 7-hour interview about the actions that were taken by Kerry when he was Secretary of State, as well as after that, and not just selling out Israel, but selling out the security of the United States.
Right. Not the first time he's done it, needless to say. It goes back to the Vietnam War, and I believe is continuing even as we speak. But that's a subject to which we will hopefully be able to return with you, Mr. Secretary, in the very near future. Thank you for your time today, Bob Joseph. Always great to visit with you, and we appreciate the clarity you bring to these very important issues. Come back to us soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.